environmental, hazard, financial, malfeasance, and litigation risks. Here we discuss preventive, proactive, and contingent/corrective, reactive, responses to environmental, hazard, financial, malfeasance, and litigation risks. It is important to prepare both types of responses when feasible. Responding to environmental risks. Exhibit 7-18 provides examples of preventive and contingent/corrective action plans for environmental-related risks. Exhibit 7-18. Responses to environmental risks. While environmental regulations are often perceived as a burden, they tend to develop or change slowly, so the organization should have ample time to develop a response plan. Responding to hazard risks. Two important means of addressing hazard risks are contingency planning for business continuity and purchasing the right amount and types of insurance. Avoidance of working in certain geographic areas or geographic diversification can also help. A brief overview of insurance is provided next. Types of insurance. Exhibit 7-19 reviews various types of insurance for the supply chain. Exhibit 7-19. Types of insurance for supply chain. Responding to financial risks. When responding to financial risks related to the insolvency of a customer or supplier, some traditional preventive measures include monitoring their financial ratios and metrics that predict bankruptcy risk, contracting with alternate suppliers, or diversifying the customer base. Some contingent measures include loans, possible mergers, and litigation. In regard to market volatility and credit risk, preventive measures include developing larger cash balance cushions, maintaining unused credit facilities, and developing specific contingency plans for serious reductions of revenue streams, including what products or services will be trimmed or stopped first. For commodity price risk, responses include buying larger quantities of rare raw materials than are needed when the prices are favorable and purchasing of hedging instruments, as discussed below. Hedging can also be used for currency exchange risk, but another option is to avoid the risk by buying and selling in the home country currency whenever the other party also agrees to it. If the party maintains a foreign currency account, it can use these funds for all transactions in that currency. The transaction becomes risk transfer if the other party will need to exchange the foreign currency. In this case, it will require different pricing as a compensation. The parties can also agree to share these risks, splitting the burden between both parties. An example of this is an agreement to revisit a price when it comes nearer to the payment being due, and then to take into account changes in exchange rates. This is called a formal currency review and would need to be specified in the contract and be subject to legal and financial review. Hedging. Hedging is a risk transfer tool for commodities, currency exchange, and financial instruments. Hedging is often used to lock in a price now for something that needs to be purchased in the future, such as a commodity or a foreign exchange transaction. By locking in the price now, the organization is transferring the risk of the price going in an unwanted direction to the party offering the hedging instrument. The organization is also sacrificing the benefit it would receive if the price of the underlying asset being hedged goes in a favorable direction. In this sense, a long-term contract with a supplier that fixed prices is a form of hedging, since the supplier bears the risk of the costs of its raw materials going up, but cannot pass on those costs. For this reason, many fixed-price contracts have escape clauses in the event of severe commodity or foreign exchange rate changes. The opposite of hedging is speculation. The hedger is working to reduce risk, uncertainty, not to increase profits. The speculator is the other party to a hedging transaction, who is betting in the opposite direction to make a profit. It is absolutely critical to have financial experts arrange hedges, and that even these experts have governance review. Hedging can become speculation in the hands of inexperienced persons. Hedging can create large liabilities that must be settled. Hedging does not guarantee a favorable result. Three types of hedging instruments are forwards, futures, and options. Forwards and futures are very similar. The key difference is that forwards are customized deals between two parties. The other is often a bank, while futures are standardized deals offered by large financial exchanges in standard amounts and for a limited number of currencies and commodities. Otherwise, the two instruments serve the same purpose: lock in a price now for something needed in the future. Both are mandatory, meaning that you need to settle them regardless of what the market does. Forwards are often used for things not on the organized exchanges or when another party offers customized terms that fit very well. A risk is that the other party will default. This risk is very low when working with an exchange, but it can be significant with other parties. An option is like a forward or a future, except that you have the option to use it or not. You pay the writer a premium fee to gain this flexibility. The fees can be sizable and must be taken into account when calculating the overall savings or loss from the hedge. For example, if oil options are offered at 65 euros per barrel, and you purchase an option to buy 100,000 barrels of oil next year for a premium of 5 euros per barrel, then you are effectively paying 70 euros per barrel. But at least you have some budget certainty. If the price were 66 euros per barrel, you would exercise the option and pay 65 euros plus 5 euros per barrel, since the fee is due either way. The market price would need to be higher than 70 euros per barrel to be a real savings. If the price was €50 per barrel, however, you would not use the option and would buy on the open market, but would still need to pay the 5 euro per barrel fee as well. Responding to malfeasance risks. Responses to theft and other loss, bribery, abduction, corruption, counterfeiting, and other forms of criminal behavior need to be comprehensive and start at the top of the organization in the form of good governance and clearly stated policies and procedures. A good general response is to set up a comprehensive security system for the supply chain. A relevant standard to guide such a system is ISO 28000. As defined in the ISCM Supply Chain Dictionary, ISO 28000 is an international standard developed by the International Organization for Standardization, ISO, that specifies the requirements for a security management system, including those aspects critical to security assurance of the supply chain. Other examples of responses follow: theft, damage, and vandalism. Theft, damage, vandalism, and other forms of loss of goods can be combated in part by investing in information gathering and sharing. Organizations exist that track thefts and help coordinate theft incident communications, recovery, and deterrence, thus helping to coordinate the responses of law enforcement in multiple countries. For example, the CargoNet platform provides near real-time theft alerts to organizations and law enforcement. Loss of goods can be mitigated by insurance, but insurance cannot immediately replace inventory, nor will it fully reimburse a loss if there is a deductible. Proper security and handling procedures can reduce the occurrence of internal and external threats to inventory loss. Many of these procedures involve setting and enforcing proper operational and financial controls. One example of a key control is segregation of duties. For example, a warehouse employee should not be able to approve a material move and also carry out the move. Matching of invoice to purchase order and receiving documents is another control. Incomplete enforcement or special exceptions for controls can cause problems. For example, one organization had a rule that prohibited unauthorized vehicles from parking in the warehouse yard. An exception was made for one employee, and one night after work, he discovered a package taped to the underside of his bumper. He informed security, and they left the package in place, eventually discovering a ring of warehouse employees engaging in theft. While the employee with the vehicle was trustworthy, the exception to the control had been costly to the organization. Other examples of preventive security measures include the following: reducing product complexity or standardizing parts across product families to reduce the total number of supply chain sourcing risks, rerouting shipments to avoid problem areas, installing ISO/PIS-17712 approved seals on shipping containers. ISO/PIS-17712, 2010 is the ISO publicly available specification. PIS, regulating classification and the use of seals on shipping containers. Selecting safer transportation modes. For example, rail is less vulnerable to hijacking than trucks. Preventive equipment handling measures may involve finding ways to reduce lead times for perishable inventory, redesigning packaging to compensate for poor handling by third-party shippers, ensuring that containers are watertight, or regularly maintaining refrigeration equipment. One example of a preventive measure against risk of loss from truck accidents practiced in Europe is to have the truck driver drive onto a railway flat car and sleep while the truck and its goods are transported by rail, which reduces the likelihood of the driver falling asleep and complies with regulations for drivers' hours of operations while keeping the truck moving. This is also an example of a situation where one response can mitigate two risks, since railway travel also reduces the risk of hijacking. The rail portion of the journey could be timed to occur in countries where hijacking risk is considered more significant. Bribery. A good preventive response for bribery is to invest in visibility. Cloud-based software can help headquarters arrange and supervise supplier selection, due diligence, ongoing contacts, approvals, and payments. These anti-bribery systems help with information gathering, regulatory compliance, and investigations and rate third parties by assessing and scoring their bribery and corruption risk. Fraud and corruption. Fraud and corruption can occur internally as well as with suppliers. Both internal and external risks need to be addressed by following best practices. The U.S. Conference Board and the Center for Responsible Enterprise and Trade have published a report that lays out a compliance program. Due diligence. Examine both legal and financial records, as well as government relations, policies, and ethics. Contractual rights. Specify compliance with laws, regulations, and anti-corruption policies, using termination clauses as a penalty. Also include the right to inspect supplier records and perform audits. Monitor and audit. Search for criminal activity. Review high-risk supplier payments, review supplier policies, recertify suppliers regularly, and conduct visits and audits. Set and enforce policies. Provide policies and education to employees on anti-corruption, internal and third-party reporting, and ongoing compliance. Set and enforce procedures. Use procedures to implement policies such as requiring signed employment agreements, team review of bids, third parties needing written policies, or multiple required approvals for third parties. Governance. Board-level governance sets the tone, and a committee reviews internal audits, legal, finance, and compliance. Procurement will often have governance duties over suppliers. Another way to combat supplier fraud and corruption is to turn to supplier co-management, which involves using a third-party supplier vetting and monitoring organizations with expertise and mature processes and systems. Since these organizations specialize in managing supplier risk, they can invest heavily in controls, monitoring software, statistical analyses, and human expertise. These can be leveraged with many suppliers and on the behalf of many clients. Spending the same amount of time and money would not be cost-effective for just one organization. Similarly, the experts at these organizations will be up to date on the latest regulations and can provide early warning of issues. Abduction. What are companies doing to protect their executives and sales representatives who frequently travel? Currently, about 75% of Fortune 500 companies invest in kidnap and ransom, K&R, insurance for their key management. The existence of K&R insurance is kept secret so as not to encourage criminals. It may even be kept secret from those who are covered so they do not start taking unnecessary risks. Many companies are now offering their key contributors training on how to keep themselves safe and minimize the risk of abduction. The companies are also hiring protection services and consulting firms to help with this goal. They recommend the creation of a written threat assessment and plan for each organization. Expatriate and other employees need to be made aware of local cultural and political situations that may put them at risk. They need to know how to avoid placing themselves in dangerous situations, such as varying their routes and regular schedules. They should avoid flashy behavior, certain neighborhoods or establishments, and carrying a corporate credit card or other ways to easily determine one's ransom value. They also need to be taught what to do and what not to do if they are kidnapped. Executives should understand that negotiations will be handled by security consultants and insurance professionals. Executives should not attempt to escape or negotiate with the criminals. Unfortunately, the successful and dramatic escapes of kidnapped victims often portrayed in movies do not reflect reality, counterfeiting and intellectual property infringement. The key to reducing the impact of counterfeiting is to know when it is occurring. When an organization's suppliers turn to gray markets to meet demand in excess of capacity, they are not only risking a loss of quality, but are also performing an illegal act. A way to combat this has arisen in the marketplace. Franchise excess and obsolete, E&O. Dealers are organizations that buy up excess or obsolete inventory and then sell it to suppliers if demand returns. Dealers who offer guaranteed product traceability can sell original inventory back to suppliers in many cases. Requiring this traceability can reduce the risks of counterfeits being introduced. An organization that is taking the lead on anti-counterfeiting measures in the U.S. is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NRC, which faces such significant risk from counterfeits ending up in nuclear plants that it has promoted tough measures to combat counterfeiting. In addition to policies such as regularly auditing not only suppliers, but also distributors. It also stresses ways to detect if parts are genuine and to trace products. Thermomechanical analysis and advanced scanning technologies are being used to scan parts as they arrive. For traceability, it is using advancements in blockchain, serialization, and product tags. Another example is a unique DNI marking produced by Applied DNI Sciences that is visible only in ultraviolet light and uses a plant-based electronic signature marking that can differ for each manufacturer. They also have methods of testing the makeup of various raw materials in textiles. In addition to testing and tagging goods, organizations can encourage their distributors to look for counterfeits and inform them when counterfeits are found. They can educate employees and channel partners regarding counterfeit problems. Research by Chaudhry et al. Indicates that these regular discussions with channel partners can be effective. However, their research also states that advertising the inferiority or dangers of counterfeits to customers or providing rewards to distributors for not purchasing counterfeits has proven less effective. The research points to the following additional countermeasures for protecting intellectual property. Ensure that all trademarks and patents are registered in all countries where there is significant demand for the product. Do this quickly in foreign countries. For example, the first to file a trademark in China owns it. Create an enforcement team that finds counterfeits for sale and follows up with investigative work, legal action, and law enforcement contact. Pursue actions not only against manufacturers, but also distributors and retailers offering counterfeit goods or using the organization's brand. Create a database for tracking counterfeits and their resolution status. To protect intellectual property when traveling to certain high-risk countries, leaving sensitive data or even data storage devices at home may sometimes be the best protection. Other protections against intellectual property infringement include the following. Develop internationally recognized contracts that adhere to the Convention on the International Sales of Goods, CISG, and check parties' references thoroughly. Engage in trade dress protection, which protects against look-alike products with minor changes and is enforceable under the U.S. Digital Millennium Copyright Act for online materials. Learn which countries are high risk and avoid doing business in these places or take extra precautions when it is necessary. Consider establishing operations in foreign countries or at least gain access to local expert representation for greater control and business savvy. Local representatives can be given purchasing authority in the form of a purchasing office, which helps to evaluate suppliers. Whenever possible, directly pursue offenders in that country's court system. If a government is failing to enforce its intellectual property laws and the organization is large enough to be considered an asset to that government, the organization can threaten to pull operations out of that country. Responding to lawsuit risks. According to an article by Michael Metzger, a Kelley School of Business professor at Indiana University, following a number of basic rules can help reduce the risks of legal losses. These rules are paraphrased as follows. View your actions from the perspective of how a jury would see them. Adhere to the truth and ethical standards. Don't seek trouble, but assume it is seeking you and watch for it. Invest in the details, because a small issue can sometimes end in a large cost. Always stay professional, unemotional, and imperturbable. Emotional reactions can provide grounds for the opposition, and pursuing some cases can cost far more than settling. Document everything. Don't make policies unless you intend to enforce compliance. Pretending a problem doesn't exist and trying to forestall the inevitable are futile and costly endeavors.